Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing interviews I did with Charlie Tyler and Rita Korn, who are starring in the Lemon Bay Playhouse production of Harvey, which, as Charlie mentions in his interview, is the sixth longest-running play in Broadway history. And when you see it, you know why. Because it touches on the human problems which most of us are dealing with, if not in the outrageous way that they are dealt with in Harvey. So, hang on. Here come the show. Show is about being the person you were meant to be so you can live the life you were meant to live. As I say in virtually every show, you wouldn't think this would be such a hard thing, but in fact, it is. In fact, few of us get out of our childhood with all of who we are intact. How can this happen? Well, if you've been listening, you know I'm a psychotherapist, and that what I believe is that most of us come out of our childhood demonstrating some portion of who we are, but not the entire truth about who we are. And I call this portion that we demonstrate our cover story. Cover story, as in what a spy does. Has a cover story to protect themselves from exposure, because should they be known to be what they really are, they would be in danger. And I believe this is exactly what happens to us as children. In some way, we decide, accurately or inaccurately, sometimes we make a mistake, but it doesn't matter once we have decided it's in stone, that some quality about us, something that we do or look like or act like or think, is going to bring an unfortunate, unpleasant consequence. And this is just not an option. We cannot tolerate being wrong or bad or different often. In some cultures, in some families, being different is really not okay. So depending on where we get this information that this thing about us is no good or undesirable, and how powerful the message is. Obviously, if a parent lets us know in no uncertain terms that crying is taboo, you know, big boys don't cry, or nice girls don't cry, or whatever the message is, and that that message comes with a withdrawal of attention, affection, love, sometimes with punishment or trauma. So if the message is strong enough and it comes with a powerful enough instruction, then we learn quite soon that that quality, whatever it is, in this case, you know, I've mentioned crying, that quality needs to disappear. And we begin quite quickly to put the kibosh, that's a technical term, kibosh, on that quality. And what happens is our brain puts together the stimulus and the response. So when we cried, we got this response that was really unpleasant. And our brain learns that that action, cry, is likely to bring this terrible response. And the brain drops a chemical in our bloodstream which inhibits the response. So over time, without even noticing it, reflexively, we don't cry. We get the impulse to cry because that's a naturally occurring response. Our brain says, oi, oi, I know that one, that's going to bring something terrible, and it drops a chemical in our bloodstream that inhibits the tears. And so you meet people who say, oh, I just never cry. I don't know why. I'm just not a crier. You know, even at the weirdest things, you know, the things that other people cry at, I just don't cry. I don't know. Tears just don't come to my eyes. Well, the brain, I like to call the brain the world's best labor-saving device, because, of course, it learns to connect, as I said, stimulus with response. And this is how we get through life. We couldn't get up and get out of bed if our brain had not learned, you know, how to tie our shoes, put on our clothes, use a fork, not run out in front of traffic. I mean, our brain has learned all this stuff, and that is how we survive. But it has also learned some things which inhibit behaviors of ours which we actually need. So maybe you would disagree, maybe you would say to me when I say that it's really important for people to be able to cry, to express sadness or distress. Maybe you're one of those people who doesn't cry, and so you would tell me that that's absolutely not true. It's okay not to cry, crying is expendable. But I don't believe it. And I have lots of evidence. For one thing, if you can't express your sadness and distress, you cannot receive comfort. Other people cannot know that you are in distress. I'm thinking here, actually, of a case where I was called to testify. In a court case. A lawyer referred this client to me. This was a man who had been in a terrible freak accident. He was driving down the Grapevine in California, and a truck, a huge truck, smashed into him. And he lost the ability to raise his arm past a certain place, and he was experiencing, obviously, a lot of pain. And so they were suing the company, and the lawyer said to me, the client, is unable to really present how devastating this has been to his life. And as a result, he's not likely to achieve the result we want him to achieve. He can't work, and he needs as much money as we can get in this case. But if he is going to keep behaving as though this is no big deal, we're not going to be able to do that. So he came in to see me, and we began to look at why it was so hard for him to demonstrate what was patently the truth, which was that his life was completely devastated by this. He was a carpenter, a fine carpenter. And so he could no longer do that. And his hobbies, which were fishing and guitar playing, also he could no longer do. This had completely undermined his entire life. And obviously he was distraught over this, but you would not know it to hear him talk about it. Well, after quite a lot of work, we did actually discover the source of this inability to show distress. This man was the youngest child of eight in a very, very poor family. Father worked 24/7, mother completely overwhelmed. But she loved all her children, but this little boy was her favorite. And when he would cry, she could not bear it. And so she would say to him, "Go to the crying bridge. Go do that over there. Don't do that over here." And he had a very powerful memory, which we were able to uncover, of his being perhaps 4 years old and going off to the crying bridge to cry his tears and looking back at his mother and seeing the look on her face, which he understood to mean that his tears were too painful for her. She didn't have the energy or the capacity to comfort him, and it was too hurtful for her to see him in pain. And at four, he determined he would not do that to her again. He would not cry. He would not admit distress or pain. And he grew up to be what he called himself, these are his words, the tower of strength for everyone that he knew or cared for. His mother, his wife, his friends, his everybody. He was the tower of strength. So here he was confronted with this dilemma. Could he abandon being the tower of strength, even if the price he was going to pay for it was going to damage the entire rest of his life? I am happy to say that we were able to help him recover his ability to demonstrate his distress. And it not only was a powerful experience in the court, which awarded him $1 million, which at that time was a huge, well, it's still a lot of money, but at the time it was huge. But in addition to that, it changed his relationships in a way that was really beneficial for everybody. He, his wife, his mother, everyone. So you understand that there are times in our lives when those qualities which we have had to deny become essential to our well-being. So that's what the Lynn Show is about. And as you can hear, I talk about that in the show. And also, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do this because in order to do that in this culture, it has to be who you really are. It has to be the life you were meant to live. And when you listen to people who do that, you can hear what it sounds like. And it is my hope that between listening to what I say and listening to what it sounds like when artists speak, you might be tempted to ask yourself if there is something about you which you are in denial for, have been hiding, could benefit from getting back. Today, the interviews are really interesting because they are both actors who, by the way, I have seen in this production of Harvey, which you really want to run out and see if you're anywhere near Englewood, Florida, because even just to see Charlie Tyler and Rita Korn, they're wonderful. They're perfect. And what's so wonderful for me about these interviews is that both Charlie and Rita discovered a passion for acting, for theater, for storytelling so young, and yet neither was able, because of a series of events, which they will tell you about, neither one was able to study acting officially, to give that their life to theater until quite later. But they never lost it. They never lost their knowledge of who they really are. And so now, somewhat later in life than most people do this, both Charlie and Rita are getting an opportunity to be who they really are, to live the life they were meant to live, and we are getting an opportunity to benefit from these amazing talents and these courageous human beings. So, without further ado, the first interview is with Charlie Tyler, and the second with Rita Korn. Here, Charlie Tyler. Hi. So here I am with Charlie Tyler in my kitchen, because he was kind enough to drive down here. And I'm interviewing Charlie because he is in the production of Harvey at the
Lemon Bay Playhouse. Yes, down in Englewood, Florida. And I play Elwood P. Dowd.
Yes.
I always joke that I auditioned for the part of Harvey because I disappear so well on stage, but then a rabbit showed up and got the part.
Of course. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, the art to which you are giving a big chunk of your life is acting, theater.
Yes, live theater. I've loved live theater since I was in first grade.
And that's my question. What was the very first moment you can remember?
I can remember it very well. I was in first grade, and we put on a play about adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing. And I played Mr. Minus. I wore a black suit, and I had a rhinestone minus sign on my arm.
Oh, this
I came
is
out
great.
On stage, and that was my first taste of what it was like to be on a stage and act in front of people.
And clearly you remember it to this day.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so, okay, so was there follow-up to that? I mean, did you go home saying, wow, 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 you know?
I really can't remember. I do know that both my mother and my father were very much involved in live theater. They loved, like, my father was a New York tax lawyer, but he was a theater junkie, and he would drag me here, there, and everywhere to see plays.
Are you an only child?
Yes, I was an only child, and my mother died when I was quite young, so I spent a lot of time with my dad.
Oh.
She was a very artistic person, and she loved theater, too. They both did. They loved to go to see shows.
Okay, so you knew about this in some way before you started going to shows. I mean, did they start taking you in the first grade?
No. I think my dad, I remember my dad dragging me to, in Manhattan, to a little hole-in-the-wall theater that was, you know, brownstone down in the basement. They were called the Shakespeareites. He somehow thought that Julius Caesar would appeal to a 9-year-old. So that's what I saw, but I remember being totally fascinated. I didn't really understand all that was going on, nor did I understand the language, but I found it fascinating that all these people were fighting and falling on their swords and assassinating other people, and it looked like they were just having a blast doing it. So, yeah, I began to think this is something that looks interesting and something that I would enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when that started, when you started to think, gee, this might be fun, I'd like this, and whether you discussed it with your dad?
I don't remember discussing it with anyone.
Mm.
My teacher in elementary school, I think, encouraged me to do it. And my parents certainly didn't discourage me. My dad was always encouraging. but I don't remember having a discussion with him about it. I do remember graphically having a discussion with him about being a professional actor.
Let's go back a little bit, because I'm always interested in the influence of teachers. This comes up so often, either positive or negative. So you had a teacher in elementary school who you remember as encouraging you to perform?
Oh, yes. Her name was Christy Barnes.
And this is another thing. Everybody remembers the teacher. It's amazing. So do you remember what she said? She said, God, you're a funny guy, or you're an interesting, you know.
I think this is something that you enjoy doing.
Wow. So she really validated it.
Oh, yes. And the school that I went to, was a Rudolf Steiner school, they were very, very much into the arts.
Mm.
So that's why we were doing plays about math and plays about
the
other things.
So this was a private school?
Yeah, mm-hmm. In New York.
Right. And so they were, as they quite often can be, interested in developing the whole person.
Yes.
Right, right. So they had, of course, so you were acting out, you know, subtraction with multiplication. It's fascinating. So were you in plays in elementary school, junior high school like that?
I was. The school, the eighth grade usually did two shows before they moved on to the high school. And one of them was a traditional Christmas pageant. And I played Joseph in that. The other was usually chosen by a teacher, and we did a Molière piece called The Would-Be Gentleman.
My goodness.
And I played Monsieur Jardin.
Wow.
In that. And those are the two that I really remember.
Yeah, right.
Because I had big roles.
I was just going to say, in the Christmas pageant, aside from God, you're the star.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, that's great. Okay, so then high school, was there more? Or
high school, I went away to boarding school, and from a non-traditional elementary school.
Oh, yeah.
Even though Rudolf Steiner was a private school, it was not a traditional elementary school. And I went to a very traditional boarding school in Massachusetts. And I really didn't have an opportunity to act, or didn't take an opportunity to act, until my junior year. And then I was in a couple of plays. One, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, was my first role in drag. I played Elaine, the secretary, because it was an all-boys school. You know.
Yeah.
You had to have women. You
yeah.
had to use boys. And the other one was T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral.
Mm. Okay, so now you're getting out of high school, and
yep.
you're thinking about what you're going to do for college.
Mm-hmm.
And I am assuming this is when you had the meeting with Dad.
No, I went off to Hamilton College in upstate New York, a very traditional liberal arts college, which was all male still at that point, now co-ed happily. And I didn't...
Was this your choice?
It was probably what people wanted for me. Mm-hmm. And I...
Good boy that
sort
you
of
are.
Along.
Right.
And in college, I really didn't act. I got away from it. And I think I was somewhat at sea, as they say, for a number of years. And then I decided that I needed to go. I ended up getting dismissed at the end of my junior year because I was...
I was just
going
to
classes. I wasn't doing anything particularly productive with my time, so they said sayonara. And I worked in New York for a while.
This is a clue, right? That there's nothing that captures you. That you left behind what captured you, and now...
Yeah, and...
Right?
I did, and I had lots of friends who were involved in theater in New York. I worked at various fairly menial jobs for a while. And then I talked with my dad about maybe being a professional actor, and he did not want me to do that, as I think most parents would say, what are you, crazy? You're out of your mind. I also saw how many, many talented people there were around and how difficult a business it was. I did go around and audition for some things, but you can't audition when you say, oh, I was in high school. What have you done? Nice to see you.
Joseph.
We'll call you back. Take your shirt off. Put your shirt on. Goodbye. One day I concluded that I had unfinished business. I needed to get my degree, and that if I was really going to pursue acting in any way, I had to have a fallback position. I had to have something else that I could do. So I went up to Boston, and I went into Boston University, and I said, here are the college credits I have. Will you give me a chance? And they did.
Good for them.
And then I ended up graduating from there.
Well, did you ever pick a major?
Yes, I was an English major.
Oh, okay, good. Mm-hmm.
And I graduated from there, and people were saying, well, what do you want to do? My dad said, you're going to go to law school, and blah, 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 blah. So I thought, well, maybe I'd like to teach. I had worked in summer camps, enjoyed working with children. So I went off, actually, back to the old boarding school that I had been at, and I taught there for 5 years, and then I taught for another 25 at Greenwich Academy in Greenwich, Connecticut, where I ran an English department, I ran an upper school, I did college advising, I did all sorts of things, but I never got out of the classroom. And I developed a very strong interest in Shakespeare, so I used to do a lot of Shakespeare with my students, and we never did it in the classroom. We always went down to the theater to do it. I ended up doing some acting in the summers. I directed some. We did a bunch of student faculty productions, both at Berkshire School, where I went, and at Greenwich Academy, where I ended up working. And so I did theater as I could. And when I came down to Florida, I began doing a lot of work with nonprofits. And so I got involved with a little theater in Boca Grande, Florida called Royal Palm Players, and I did a bunch of shows for them. I did some work up in Connecticut.
So now this is really interesting. You've actually not had any training of your own.
Oh yeah, I have. I worked with an actor named Paul Rudd. Not the Paul Rudd of film. Mm-hmm. They actually had a thing about him. This Paul Rudd I got to know when I was working in Greenwich, and he was a very accomplished actor. He'd done a lot of work with Joe Papp. He'd been in a couple of TV series, and he was a great guy, unfortunately now dead. But we had a group that got together on Saturdays called the Terribly Serious Repertory Company for Partially Enabled Adults. And we all shared a love of Shakespeare, so we did that. But what we spent a lot of time doing was going around town doing shows to raise money for schools, for libraries, for whatever. And we would always find some sort of creative place to do that. And there was always a scene from Shakespeare somewhere in the mix. But it was song, dance, light patter, and all sorts of different things. And Paul had a very big influence on me. I ended up helping him run camp for disadvantaged children from Norwalk, from inner city Norwalk, that was all about theater, musical theater, all the rest of it. But I guess you could say I picked up stuff
from everywhere
along the way. Mm-hmm. I love to watch actors work. I love to watch directors work. And to me, one of the great things about acting, even at my relatively advanced age, is that I always get to learn something.
Okay, so how did you wind up in Florida?
Well, I'd been to the East Coast, and I was still married at the time with two children. And we went to a little barrier island called Boca Grande and fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. And eventually bought a house there. Could no longer do now, but... and I got down there, I got involved with the health clinic and the library, and helped to found a charter school down there, and I was also involved with Royal Palm Players, and I did a lot of shows for them, and then I expanded a bit and did some shows at Lemon Bay Playhouse in Englewood, and some work up in Connecticut, but I love being involved with theaters.
Mm-hmm. Clearly. So now your current involvement is with Lemon Bay doing Harvey.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Do you want to say a little something about it, about Harvey?
Yes. I've read a bit about the play's history, and it is the sixth longest running legitimate play in Broadway history.
Wow.
It was a huge hit, and Mary Chase, who wrote it, wrote other plays, but never achieved the same measure of success that she achieved with Harvey. I've also seen the Jimmy Stewart film, and I've seen a couple of revivals of it, and it still speaks to audiences, mm-hmm. because it raises the question of quote-unquote normal people who are out there going after what they want. I want. Give me. I've got to have it. And all of the crazy, manic stuff that they're doing, and into the middle of it comes this guy who is completely at peace with himself, who sees nothing but the good in other people, who is a sweet, wonderful, outgoing, generous man, who also happens to drink a lot. And he has this 6-foot puka named Harvey, who is his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And his family doesn't know what to do. They're going crazy. His sister's going berserk. And her daughter, she wants to get married. She wants a man, but they can't bring anybody around with Uncle Elwood there. He's going to introduce them to Harvey. And he's a nutcase. The other piece of it is the man has friends everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether they're important or cab driver. He's friends with the guy who runs the grain elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises the question, what's the better reality?
Yeah, it's the question of human values.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that it's, in its way, it's a little like you can't take it with you. That family that's so, you know, interested in their particular arts, and they don't care about, you know, the world, what the world thinks. And it's got that same, I can't think of the word, but where the daughter wants to be married, but
yes.
is, right. And even that whole idea that there's a right way to be, and that if you're not that, that there's something wrong with you, and that you should be either put away or made to see the, you know, error of your ways. Yeah. And no wonder that continues to resonate, because since there is no one right way to be, a lot of us are not right.
Yeah.
You know, so it must speak to that part of everybody who sees it. It's great. Okay, so on and off, you've spent a lot of time in your life connected to theater,
mm-hmm.
right? In one way or another.
Yeah.
So do you want to just say something about what that's been like?
Oh, it's been immensely rewarding, at times incredibly frustrating.
You want to elaborate
a
little bit?
Well, I worked as an artistic director at that little theater in Boca Grande for a year. And when you get involved in theater production and that sort of thing, you are always operating at a fairly elevated emotional level, because there's always something that's going to go wrong. The set person won't show up, an actor shows up drunk, you know, it's endless. And by, you know, you think at 5 o'clock in the afternoon you've made your last phone call, and you know you haven't, because you can ask Rita about it too, she's an artistic director. There's always something else, but despite the frustration and the difficulties, when you work as a team and put together this amazing product that people come to see it, and it's live, and it's different. Every night that you do it, it's a little bit different. That's what I love so much about live theater. And the risk that you take, like working without a net, it's not pre-recorded, it's not, you go out there and you take a risk. Every time you go out there and you depend on the other people that you're working with to be there for you,
yes.
when something goes wrong. I won't say if, because something always goes wrong. And to be able to entertain people, mm-hmm. to make them laugh, to move them, that's,
yeah.
to me, that's as much fun as you can possibly have.
Yeah, and so interesting because you really discovered it in the first grade.
Yeah.
And it sounds like even though you didn't pursue it as a career, you never lost it. You never let it go. You always kept it alive for yourself.
Yeah.
That's really great. It's great. It's a good place to stop. Thank you very much,
well, thank
John.
Thank you.
So as I said, you can hear that even though he was not able to pursue this as a career, Charlie Dyler held on to his passion for theater in every single way that he could. And I hope that you get a chance to see him in this role, because then you can see what he must always have known, that he's an actor. And he does get what he wanted, which is we are entertained, delighted, and moved by his performance. So now, a similar story, ironically, from the absolutely delightful Rita Korn.
I am here with Rita Korn, who is in the production of Harvey at the Lemon Bay Playhouse. And I'm assuming you play the sister.
Yes, I do.
Elwood's.
Vita Louise Simmons.
Vita Louise Simmons, yes. Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it seems apparent that you are making at least this time in your life with the art of acting, theater. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I only ask one question,
uh-huh.
and that is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when it occurred to you that acting, play acting, having people look at you, telling stories, any of that was attractive, interesting, compelling?
Well, I think probably it started when I was very, very young, because I was one of those that had a playmate that was invisible.
Oh, you're kidding!
No,
oh,
no, Ruth, that was Ruth.
And well, it's so, too bad you can't play Elvis then,
isn't it?
Yes,
right. Mine was Ruth. And so I just...
How old were you?
I was probably about 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, and I love that. So, and I was always dancing and singing and all of that, but I didn't really get into that until after I retired, because I had to raise a family. And
well, so are you saying that in your whole early life, you didn't weren't in school plays, it never occurred to you to get on stage, you didn't, nothing?
No, very little. The little town I was from, it had very little. So the few things they did come into town and we did, yes, I would get involved with it.
Tell me about
dance and sing. Oh my goodness, that goes way back.
I know,
though.
I know, but
yeah.
Tell me.
They would bring and put together some kind of a little small musical of some kind, and we would have to go around and borrow or make our own clothes and do little dances and sing, and oh, I thought that was really something.
I'll bet you did. Now, how old are we talking about?
I was probably, I'm guessing, around 10 or 11 at that
okay,
time.
Okay, now, when you say we, was there a group of people who did this, or
it was just the young ones who I was in school with, and so on.
So a bunch of you, it's sort of like, let's put on a play?
Yes. And there would usually be an adult involved, and they'd say, oh, well, we'll help, you know, and they would start putting things together. We would use a gymnasium from the high school. And
so was these established plays, or do you make up stuff?
No, it was just makeup stuff.
Like a variety show?
Yeah, like Mickey Rooney.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay, so you started doing this at 10 with whoever else in the community or in the school or your friends
right.
or whatever
right.
wanted to do it?
Yes.
So would you do it like once a year?
Yes, probably about once a year, if that often.
Really?
Yes.
And do you remember who initiated these things?
No, I really don't.
You just know you were up for it.
Yes.
And whoever was doing
yes.
it, you were going to do
gung-ho.
It.
Gung-ho.
You were gung-ho,
yeah,
right, okay.
Let's do it.
So you would dance, you would sing, you would play act, right, or whatever it was
especially
called.
Dancing. My voice is not the greatest. I'm a character singer. I don't have a beautiful voice. I wish I did.
But you like to dance?
Yeah, oh yes, I love to dance.
Yeah. So you didn't have dance lessons or
no.
anything?
No.
No. You just had a natural feel for it, right? And so when there was a dance production, you would be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, good. So now, were there, I don't know, in your school, did they do any of that stuff?
No, it's a very small school in the southern part of Indiana, and they didn't have any of that.
Wow.
So,
Did you have movies? Did you have TV? Did you have plays? Did they bring in anything?
Yes, they had, at that time, they did have two movies, so, oh, I'd love to go to the movies, yes, oh, yes.
Yes.
I'd walk to town and go to the movies, yeah.
So. Okay, so it's clear then that you were drawn to this, the whole thing of make-believe, of play, right? So it's ironic, and I mean, I don't know, I want to say it's unfortunate, but maybe it's not, that there was no outlet for you to explore it earlier in your life. Right? Okay. So did you get married young?
Yes, very young. 17.
Yikes.
Yes.
Well, so I'm assuming that that is kind of what one did where you were from, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was the...
Yeah, because it was a poor area.
Mm-hmm. And it was the path. I mean, I'm assuming you didn't go on to college or...
No, I wasn't lucky enough to be able to do that. My father was a coal miner, and so things were
right.
Yeah.
So those things were not options, so you did what was an option.
Yes.
And also what was, I imagine, expected, desirable for a girl to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And who I met was a jazz musician. So
oh,
that was
I see. Oh, I see. Now it becomes clear.
Yes. Jazz pianist. Yes.
I see. Oh gosh.
Yes.
Yes.
So you know, kind of.
Yeah. So you did So you had access to or entree into that world.
Mm-hmm.
So
through him.
Did he travel?
He didn't travel as much once we were married. But he did not playing around. And before we were married, he played for a lot of performers, a lot of celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, of course, this goes way back. He was one of the personal piano players for Phil Harris and Alice Faye.
Oh, my.
And
oh, my.
Yeah. So, you know, he did play for a lot of us. And then when we moved down here, he played a lot of Siesta Key, Longboat Key, and all around, the jazz club and different ones.
Okay, so he made his living in that, and
yes. You
were the support team.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what made you come to to Florida?
Well, I suppose the cold weather, and he was unhappy with some of the work he was doing. So we started coming down here and checking all around, and we found we loved the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he found there was a lot of work for pianists down here. And so that's what made us move down here. So I was here about 3 years when I caught the bug and auditioned.
Ah, so now let's get to that. Okay, so fine. So I'm assuming that by the time you got here, your children were raised and
yes.
gone
yes.
or
yes.
going?
And two of them were musicians.
Oh, my dear.
Mm-hmm.
I see. So you gave your life to the art of music.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Right, you're definitely right. Right. Well, then it's so sweet. Do they both play piano?
No, one plays piano, the other plays drums.
And, a little band. You have your own little band.
Oh, yes. yes.
Right. Okay, so how did it happen that you got the bug? I mean, how did that...
Well, I was getting a little bored down here, and I happened to see in the paper, I think, where they were holding auditions at the Playhouse, Lemon Bay Playhouse, and for tribute. I remember that. And I thought, oh, this is foolish, but I really would like to. So I walked in, and I got a part right away. So it surprised me, you know, and that was it. Oh, that was it. Once I got that part, it got me.
Well, I think it would have gotten you many years earlier if you'd had an opportunity.
It
was just waiting.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. My first director, Lee Linkus, I don't know if you know Lee
or not.
Okay. But he encouraged me so I think that had a lot to do with it.
Well, yeah, you can't do without it, actually.
No.
You can't do without it.
Either.
But this is so interesting. Neither you nor Charlie actually had classical training as actors.
No.
You just have it.
No.
Right?
It
it's just
natural.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. So how long ago was it that you did your first, did you do tribute?
About 23 years ago.
Good God.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've been doing this ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, well, what did you do? You just started auditioning?
Yes, I started auditioning and looking to see where different theaters were having what plays. I did plays at Golden Apple, and I did Dinner Theater in Syracuse, New York.
Oh, how did you audition for that?
Well, I was doing some plays at the Golden Apple, and one of the actors there, Bob Brown, he said, he liked me right away. We got along so well. And he said, I'm probably going to go back up to Syracuse. He says, if I do, he says, I want you to come up and do Driving Miss Daisy for me.
Oh, my goodness.
Sure enough, he did. He went back up there and opened this dinner theater, and they took me up there, and I did Driving Miss Daisy there. So I did it 3 times.
Oh, it's wonderful.
No, I love it.
It's a great part.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's a great part. So this is so interesting. I mean, I love this, really. That you discover this interest, this passion, this alive thing inside of you as a very little girl, as a very young girl, really. And then it sort of sits on the shelf, you know, waiting.
I had to put it aside, yeah.
Right. And then you become the support team for a family of male musicians.
Okay, right.
You know, who, and I imagine a very enthusiastic audience for them.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And encouragement.
A lot of followers.
Right. But all the things that you didn't really get for it, you were able to give to them, right? And then, amazingly, you get, 23 years. A lot of people don't have a 23-year career. Yeah. You know, so, that's wonderful.
Boys love it. They love it every time.
Do they?
Oh, yes.
They come to see you?
Well, one of them has been able to. The other two haven't been able. I've never seen me.
Oh, you have three?
Yes, I have three.
And only two are musicians?
Yeah, twins are musicians. I have identical twins.
Ah.
And those are the musicians. And the older one is not. He could be, but he's not. Yeah.
Well, maybe. I mean, you don't ever know.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right. There you go. Yeah. Right. Late in
life. Yeah, right. It might run in the genes.
Right.
Right. Okay, so I think Charlie mentioned that you are an artistic director, is that correct?
It's really artistic and production manager. So I was the artistic manager. And then they decided they want me to take on both roles. So I'm doing both roles now.
Is it for Lemon Bay?
Yes. Yes.
Do you want to describe what the one was and what the two are?
Okay, the artistic manager, that person is in charge of a lot of the areas. In other words, I'm in charge of the committee for selecting the plays. I'm in charge of all of the auditions that go on there. I'm in charge of anything dealing with the artistic part of the theater. And then the production part is, like it says, I'm in charge of anything
Good
dealing
grief.
With... Yes. I find myself going and coming at times. So when I want to get in a play or...
Oh,
or,
my goodness, in addition.
Yes. So and I direct, too. So I love directing.
So you're making up for a hell of a lot of lost time
yes.
here. You're just doing everything, right?
Yes, which I love all of it, but it's hard. Acting is my number one, so it hurts when I can't. Yeah, something. I was lucky enough to be in Harvey, but sometimes I can't if my work is too heavy.
Well, I mean, forgive me, but acting is, especially, I mean, I don't remember Harvey, I don't remember the play, but I will come and see you, so, but I'm imagining that this is a text-heavy play, that there's a lot of words, and that takes a lot of time.
Yes.
To learn.
Oh, yes.
You know, not to mention, you know, the blocking. You don't learn blocking, and then you have to, you know, and then there's rehearsal time.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is labor intensive to act.
Yes.
But what you're describing as your other gig is beyond labor intensive. I mean, how do you get home to walk the dogs? I don't know.
Yeah, I have to find time for that, too. You're right.
I
you have to write.
Yeah. Okay, so well, I am even more amazed and grateful that you came out here to do this because you can't possibly have very much spare time.
No, there's time. Right now, it's a little better than it has been, but when I'm involved with getting directors for the plays and all of that, at the same time that I'm trying to also, I'm getting contracts out and getting entertainers for what we call our showcase. Between shows, we bring in entertainments, and I'm in charge of getting that. And sometimes when that all comes together, I don't know if I'm going or coming. Right now, I have that done, so It's like,
my God, they're so lucky to have you.
They
are so lucky to have you. I mean, any one of these is a full-time job.
Yes.
Right? And to be willing to take all that on and to be as conscientious as you are.
Yeah. Well, it's considered a part-time.
I'm sure it is.
Considered part-time. But as you say,
I'm sure they just pay for it part-time, but that doesn't mean... Yes, I know all about that. I know all about that. Okay, so maybe you want to talk a little bit about Harvey, about the show.
Harvey is a wonderful play. I was in Harvey at the Golden Apple when the Golden Apple had Venice. Remember, they had a theater in Venice.
Oh, no, I wasn't here then.
Okay, they had a theater in Venice. They had the one in Sarasota, but also there. And they did Harvey. And they picked me to play two parts, Mrs. Chauvenet and Betty Chumley, which is what Carol is doing with one of our actors, which is a great thing to do because those are both good characters. And I enjoyed it so. It's just a delightful play. Mm-hmm. It's every part in there is great. There isn't a part that isn't important to that play.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Okay, you know, I need you to tell me when it's opening.
Okay, it's opening May the 1st.
Mm-hmm. And how long will it run?
It runs 3 weeks.
Okay, all right.
And it runs Wednesday through Sunday. So Wednesday evenings and then Sunday afternoon performances.
Is the Wednesday the opening night?
Yes.
All right,
yes.
Good.
Put it on my calendar, the 1st.
All right, great. You've had a really interesting and not a usual life, you know? Do you just want to say something about the way your life worked out?
I think I was very fortunate. My life could have turned into opposite direction if it hadn't been for my husband, I think. He encouraged me in everything. And I learned a lot more about music than I had known before.
Yes.
And
I bet that helps in your current job.
Absolutely. And how wonderful musicians are and theater people.
Yes.
Come to that. So... yeah, I think it's enriched me with all of that, even though I wasn't able to actually act until I was older. I think everything that I did led in that direction.
I think so, too.
We have a hard time sometimes getting the young people that we need for the plays. I've got lists and lists and lists of anyone that I've ever been involved with, so, you know, we call. And this play, we're very lucky that we have obtained. In fact, we have some, I think it's 3 actors that have never been on stage acting.
You're
before.
Kidding.
And I think they're going to be very natural. And it's good to see that, and you see them growing. Of course, Carol knows how to work with them.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Yes.
Okay, we're talking about Carol Kleinberg, who is the director.
Yes.
Yes. And of course, this is lovely for you because it gives you an opportunity to give someone else the opportunity that you had.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
Yes. And they're so excited about it, it makes you feel good. Oh, they're excited.
Yeah, that's right. And then you can do for them what the first director did for you, right? You can
encourage.
Yeah.
Yes. And I love to coach, although I haven't had to for this play because Carol is so good about working with them.
Yeah, she is. Oh, coach, yet another thing you do, right?
Yes, yeah, that's one of the other little side things I do.
This has been lovely. Thank you very much, Rita.
Well, thank you.
You're
it's
welcome.
A pleasure.
So there you have it, the living, breathing example of people whose life circumstances made it difficult for them to be all that they actually knew that they were, but who were able to hold on to that knowledge, to keep it as a shining light inside of them, and take every opportunity, the minute the opportunity arose, to express that part of themselves. So, it is my hope, as I said earlier, and say always, that you are inspired to ask yourself, is there something inside of me, a little light that's still burning, that I am not able to demonstrate? And it doesn't have to be a skill like being an actor. It can be a quality like your ability to express sadness, your ability to stand up for yourself, your silliness, your thoughtfulness. There are we human beings are capable of suppressing just about everything. So if you have the idea, the thought, the possibility that there's something about you that you've been hiding, and you want to explore that. As I said, I'm a psychotherapist. All of my practice is on the telephone these days, so you don't have to be nearby me to talk to me. And if you do want to talk to me, then you probably want to go up on my website, which is thelynshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. thelynshow.com. There's a tab for email me, so you can email me and I'll get back to you. There's a there's an article on the website called Psychotherapy on the Go, which talks about therapy on the phone. And this show and the podcasts for all of my shows are up on the website, so you can listen to this again if you like, and all of the people that I have interviewed in the past. So once again, as I always do, I have to thank Josh Hackney, who is my technological savior. And if you need any help with anything technological, you want Josh, and you can get him the way you can get me, which is at my website, thelynshow.com. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that interested you, made you laugh, made you think. Something that intrigued you. Something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten